Welcome to session 322, Activists in Mormonism, Using the Experience of Modern Activists to Give Context to Ancient Scripture. Please turn off all your cell phones and other noisemakers, you know the drill. Don't forget to consider donating to Sunstone out in the lobby. You can get all the information there. Is it working? Can you guys hear me? It's very, okay. I'll just speak loud in this. Okay. There's been a little change to the program. We only have two presenters. And the first presenter is Marshall Thompson. And he received a bachelor's degree in journalism from Utah State University and is finishing a master's degree in mass communication from Ohio University. He has worked as a journalist for such publications as the Salt Lake Tribune, the Standard Examiner, and the Associated Press in Jerusalem. He also served as a journalist for the U.S. Army in Iraq, Kosovo, and South Korea. Following a one-year deployment to Iraq, he embarked on a 500-mile peace walk through Utah and made a documentary about his journey. Marshall is currently working as the online marketing director for Advent Creative in Logan, Utah. And then Kristen Olson studied anthropology at Utah State and went on to earn a master's degree in second language teaching. She has studied and worked abroad in China, Jerusalem, and Costa Rica, and South Korea. She co-directed a soldier's piece, an award-winning film about her husband, Marshall, and his peace activism in Utah. She and Marshall are the recipients of the Isabella Canta Award for Social Justice. Kristen is currently working as an adjunct professor at Utah State and is researching language use in Palestine. So let's get started.
Well, hello, thanks for coming. Is this loud enough? Okay. Kristen and I are going to switch off a little bit as we go throughout this to share different personal experiences that we've had. So, people often find themselves in a position to stand up for what they believe in direct opposition to the power structure of the cultural hegemony of their day. When people in such a situation endeavor through means of persuasion to change the minds of their contemporaries, we consider this to be activism. Activists appear as characters throughout history, and their titles are as varied as their results. However, certain aspects of the activist model are surprisingly consistent and create a great body of shared experience. Our purpose with this paper is to use our personal experiences as activists and the stories of activists in the modern iteration of the Church of Jesus Christ to enrich our understanding of activist figures in ancient scripture. For this purpose, we offer the following definition of activist: someone who works towards social or environmental justice through speaking and acting in direct opposition to the existing hegemony. Most often through nonviolent means, the activist attempts to change the status quo for the better as it pertains to his or her particular mission or cause. Looking at important scriptural figures through the lens of activism admittedly leads to a certain level of bias in interpretation. As the saying goes, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. In our examination, we've highlighted anecdotes in the lives of these notable people that correspond with the common experience of activists. This does not mean that these scriptural figures can only be understood through that lens. It's just one way of looking at it that we think can be helpful. The need for understanding in this regard is immense. Important scriptural figures lived in such antiquity that we only have scraps of manuscripts, spotty communications from the past from which we can glean insight into their lives. So to fill in the gaps left by the ravages of time on our records, we make the grand assumption that life in the past was not too different from life in the present. We assume, along with the preacher in Ecclesiastes, that there is nothing new under the sun. Quote, "The thing that hath been is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It hath been done already of old time, which was before." Ecclesiastes 1, chapter 9, verse 9 and 10. As a soldier in Iraq, I became aware of the incredible accuracy of Mormons' comments on war. The war chapters in the Book of Mormon always bothered me because I found them disturbing and they were apparently useless. Living in a war zone, however, I came to love those chapters. Mormon became my guide on how to live uprightly even in times of great evil. I became convinced that the moral and spiritual dangers of war were much greater than the actual physical threats. And Mormon describes in the war chapters, as only one who has experienced war could, how to avoid those traps. Despite hundreds of years and thousands of miles and vastly different types of conflicts, Mormon and I have a shared experience. I remember very clearly one night reading the Book of Mormon in my room. I came across a remarkable passage, Moroni chapter 3, verse 16, which reads in part, "And it came to pass that I utterly refused to go up against mine enemies, and I did even as the Lord had commanded me." It's just a scrap of information, but it struck me with tremendous force at the time. My guide was a war resister. In some ways, it may sound crass to apply a modernly political charge title such as war resister to an ancient prophet, and yet it's entirely accurate. He refused to serve his country. Looking at Mormon through the lens of activism, we can infer the context and full importance of this scrap of verse. He was in charge of the Nephite armies. Imagine today what would happen if the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff resigned and utterly refused to serve his country because it had become too bloodthirsty or too vengeful. I can imagine the loneliness that he must have felt, as well as the insults and ridicule that he must have endured for taking such a public action. I began to think that I would need to do something similar in my own small way. As we've studied the common experience of activists throughout history, several themes begin to emerge. At some point, nearly all activists have to have an awakening to a cause or a problem. It's not just an awakening, however, but a strong, persistent call to take action. My awakening moment happened my last Sunday in Iraq, and I apologize to those who've heard this story before. I've told it a few times, but this time I want to talk about the spiritual underpinnings, which I've never shared with anybody. The last Sunday in Iraq, I went to church, and our LDS group meeting had a tradition of having those who were going home stand and be recognized. And finally, it was my turn, and I was pretty happy to stand up there. And as I was about to sit down, a brother from the congregation stood up and said, and addressed us, and with tears in his eyes said, "When you get home, don't forget about us." The Spirit struck me with such force at that moment, and I began to weep with this brother whom I'd never met. At that moment, I understood perfectly what God expected me to do, and I swore to Him that I would do it. My Heavenly Father wanted me to become a peace activist. There's so many great examples of awakenings in the Scriptures. Alma the Younger and Saul on the road to Damascus come readily to mind. But my favorite, especially from the perspective of an activist, is Enoch. We'll be referring to Enoch throughout the presentation, since Enoch is truly one of the great activist figures in Scripture. As he journeyed in the land among the people, the Spirit of God descended out of heaven and abode upon him. He then heard a voice from heaven giving him a divine mission. In Moses chapter 6, verses 35-36, Enoch has his awakening moment. Quote, "And the Lord spake unto Enoch, and said unto him, Anoint thine eyes with clay, and wash them off, and thou shalt see. And he did so, and he beheld the spirits that God had created. And he beheld also things which were not visible to the natural eye. And from thenceforth came the saying abroad in the land, A seer hath the Lord God raised up unto his people." Enoch's call came in the form of a personal revelation. This is important to note because it means that you don't have to wait for an official church calling to do good works. In Doctrine and Covenants section 4, we read that if you have desires to serve God, you're called to the work. If you're awakened to a cause, you can consider that your invitation to take action. After Enoch's eyes are open, he immediately sets to work. And in Moses chapter 6, verses 37-38, we read, "Enoch went forth in the land among the people, standing upon the hills and the high places, and cried with a loud voice, testifying against their works. And all men were offended because of him. And they came forth to hear him upon the high places, saying unto the tent keepers, Tarry ye here, and keep the tents, while we go yonder to behold the seer. For he prophesieth, and there is a strange thing in the land, a wild man hath come among us." The fact that all men were offended by what Enoch had to say, and that they called him a wild man, is particularly interesting from the activist standpoint. Often those who wish to maintain the status quo will attempt to marginalize a person who is speaking out for change for social or environmental justice. And there's lots of ways this happens. Gregory Mobley wrote about the idea of the wild man in biblical, ancient Near East, and medieval literature. He observed in all the traditions that the wild man was someone who was outside of normal society. The wild man is often associated with prophecy, but the term is not necessarily a compliment. Mobley writes, quote, "The medieval man has three deficiencies. The medieval wild man has three deficiencies. He cannot talk, he cannot worship, and he is often insane. The lunatic wild man could become a prophet or a shaman." In the ancient Near East, the wild man was viewed in one of three ways: a hairy man, a subhuman barbarian, or a warrior who temporarily becomes a wild man in a fit of rage. So in most of these examples, the implication here is that Enoch is insane. He's a babbler. He's an incomprehensible outsider out on the hills saying crazy things. As a peace activist, people often question my sanity, and I think my wife did on a few occasions. But it's a common critique of any sort of activist. The Bible perspective of the wild man, however, is a little bit more positive. According to Mobley, John the Baptist, Elijah are notable wild men, as well as Samson, who's one of the deliverers of Israel. He attributes the more positive viewing of wild men among the Hebrews to their time spent journeying in the wilderness. To put it in a more modern way, one might say that the Hebrews respected the wild man because of their time spent as a repressed minority group. John the Baptist is another activist of note in the scriptures. In Doctrine and Covenants 84:28, we learn that he was ordained in his childhood to, quote, "overthrow the kingdom of the Jews and to make straight the way of the Lord before the face of the people." Talk about speaking out against the power structure and the hegemony. Understanding John through the lens of activism, we can see another note of marginalization. He's not only a wild man, but we learn from Matthew 11, chapter 11, verse 18, that people claimed he had a devil. People also accused Samuel the Lamanite, who came out of the wilderness in the Book of Mormon and stood on the city wall and spoke out in hopes of changing the status quo, that he had a devil as well and was insane. When I returned from Iraq and I started to get active in the peace movement, we felt like we were moving into the wilderness. In a literal way, I did a peace walk through Utah, 500 miles. And so in a literal sense, I did leave the cities and go out into the wilderness in Utah. But perhaps more significant than that was the spiritual journey into the wilderness. And Kristen will tell you a little bit more about that.
Okay, first I'm going to just explain my awakening to this cause of activism that we experienced. Growing up in Utah, I was aware of the current perceptions of activists in our society as crazy, long-haired hippies, or radical outsiders who were marginalized for speaking out. Although I respected the idea of activism and I did look up to activists, I was embarrassed to be viewed this way myself. At the first peace rally I attended before the war began, I stood there as a silent observer. Although I was deeply against our nation waging war with Iraq, I was embarrassed and I didn't want to be perceived as an activist or this wild person. My decision to become an activist was more of a gradual one, and I feel it happened as a direct result, in part because of my LDS upbringing. When Marshall was deployed to Iraq in 2005, I was 5 months pregnant, and I was really consumed with the feelings of hopelessness and bitterness to the circumstances that we were put in. I was so frustrated that my daughter would spend the first year of her life not knowing her dad. When I gave birth and I started to feel the responsibility of motherhood and the need to make the world a better place for my children or for my daughter, I recognized that I could no longer be a passive participant in this war or a silent observer. The symbol of the beehive in the LDS church helped me understand that I needed to be actively working to change and for a good cause. Furthermore, in DNC 58, this expanded my understanding of this idea. I read, "Verily I say unto you," this is verse 27, "men should be anxiously engaged in a good cause and do many things for their own free will and bring to pass much righteousness, for the power is in them wherein they are agents unto themselves." And as I started to recognize this and started to speak out, I did feel empowered that it refers to. And I finally did begin to feel at peace with my situation. However, like Marshall said, it was like we were journeying into the wilderness. And I began to feel that what we were doing was kind of contrary to what a lot of people felt like good LDS people should be doing. At times, I really did feel alienated from the culture and from my fellow Mormons. And at church, this was no different. We had people, when we would attend church, stand up and preach from the pulpit sometimes about how this is God's war and how we need to support our president in these times. I had a woman say to everybody that our country has never once been involved in a war that wasn't completely justified and approved by God. We also received emails from the moment we started organizing this peace walk. A lot of people made a point to tell us that they were LDS. We received emails from one email said, "If you are a Christian, then shame on you. I cannot think you are a decent person when you turn your back on the military, turn your back on the people that need your help, or need our help, and turn your back on the morals that allow this country to be free." Another LDS person wrote, "You are a pariah and a traitor, and the terrorists can only look to you as an ally to their opposition of peace in the Middle East." Someone said, "What you are doing is a joke, and I hope you get hit by a truck." Another said, "You are disgracing every American that has lost their life." Other people said things like, "We don't want you in this country anymore. Please just keep walking to Mexico and stay there. You're unpatriotic. You're a coward." It went on. It became evident as we began viewing our activism in a broader context of Mormon activists throughout history, though, that what we were enduring was not unique at all, and that other Mormons have endured much, much worse for speaking out, such as, and I apologize for my pronunciation of this person's name, but I've actually never spoken to other people about him before, so I don't know how to pronounce his name, but Helmuth Hubner?
Hubner,
thank you. Hubner, who was a war protester in Germany during World War II and beheaded by the Nazi government. I didn't know about him growing up, and it was really helpful for me to learn about other Mormon activists who had stood up for truth in times of evil. And I read the book When Truth Was Treason, edited by Blair R. Holmes and Alan F. Keel, and I learned about his story. When the war began, Helmuth's branch president put a sign on the door that said, "Jews are not allowed to enter." His branch president and other members belonged to the Nazi Party and were in full support, and many members would actively preach Nazism from the pulpit. And that sounded familiar from my perspective. Helmuth searched out truth in the midst of propaganda and lies, and with the help of two fellow teenage Mormons, started an informational resistance in Hamburg, Germany, by secretly listening to BBC broadcasts, typing up the information, sometimes using church paper to reproduce it, and distributed the information. He felt that what he was doing was absolutely justified because he was spreading truth and trying to end an illegal war, despite the fact that a lot of Mormons completely disagreed with his perspective. He told his friend that his only real crime is taking a paper from the church. He was soon arrested. His branch president tried to excommunicate him, and at the age of 17, he became the youngest resistance fighter to lose his life in this death center. And in a letter to his sister, just hours before he died, he wrote, "Please remember me kindly. I am very thankful to my Heavenly Father that this agonizing life is coming to an end this evening. I could not stand it any longer anyway. My Father in heaven knows that I have done nothing wrong. I know that God lives and he will be the proper judge of this matter." And he goes on to say, "Until our happy reunion in that better world, I remain your friend and brother in the gospel." Which I thought was significant because he knew he had been excommunicated, or thought he had been excommunicated at the time. To give you an idea of how supportive some of the LDS church members appeared to be of the Nazi party, following Helmuth's arrest, one member said, "If I had had a rifle, I would have shot him." There were LDS members who agreed with his politics as well, but not his decision to become an active resistor. And I ran into that too, people who agreed with what we were doing but stayed silent and thought that we should stay silent as well. One member wrote, "If I had been a bishop at the time, I would have forbidden Hubner from doing this because It says that we should obey the laws of the land. That does not mean that which he did, his heroism was not very courageous, but this is a completely different matter. He went against the rule, thou shalt obey the law of the land. And a German sister, LDS sister, wrote about how a lot of LDS members at the time felt like the 12th article of faith kind of justified them not speaking out against the government or doing anything to try to change it, because, of course, the blame wouldn't be on them. This idea of throwing out one's morals and sense of humanity during wartime and placing blame on your superiors or your government, I believe, is extremely misguided. And we encountered this argument from a lot of LDS people during the walk, during Marshall's peace walk. But one Mormon we learned about after Marshall returned from Iraq was named Alyssa Peterson, and she rejected this idea of misplaced blame wholeheartedly. And to borrow a term from Mormon, she utterly refused to serve. Like Huebner, it did end up costing her her life. Following an LDS mission, she enlisted in the military and was sent to Iraq. When she was placed in a torture facility called the Cage, she became extremely conflicted, as you can imagine, because her superiors asked her to use her sexuality to degrade and torture prisoners. When a fellow soldier told her she needed to separate who she was from what she was being asked to do, she replied, "I don't know how to be two people." Finally, she was reassigned duties in Iraq, and a couple weeks later, she was found dead in her room. Alyssa and Helmuth join a long group of activists and prophets who became martyrs for their beliefs. We have several ancient examples of this in the scriptures as well, but the story of Abinadi in the Book of Mormon is particularly interesting from an activist lens. Abinadi fits the activist model as he begins to preach against the power structure during the reign of King Noah. In Mosiah 17:9, we learn that Abinadi, in a form of civil disobedience, allowed himself to be arrested so that he could testify before the king. Paul allows himself to be arrested in a similar fashion in Acts 20:21. When he first meets Noah in Mosiah 13, the king tries to marginalize him by saying that he is mad. But Abinadi persists, and before he's burned alive, he is able to convince a young priest named Alma to change his ways. In this sense, Abinadi's sacrifice seems to be justified. I would suggest today that we remember Helmuth and Alyssa in the same way. If we let their examples change us for the better, the way Alma did with Abinadi, then at least on some level it justifies their sacrifices. While we made the film of Marshall's peace walk through Utah, we met some Kent State survivors who echoed this idea that they were both shot and survived and knew the people who were killed in that protest during the Vietnam War. And they said that if their protest and the aftermath did help to start turning the tide in the Vietnam War, then it was worth it to them. Not all examples of activists in the scriptures are ill-fated, like Abinadi. Some activists are met with resounding success. In Alma 26, we read about the sons of Mosiah returning from astoundingly successful missions to the Lamanites. In their revelry, we find that their mission has a dual purpose. The first was to share the gospel with the Lamanites. The second was an act of protest to prove hawkish Nephite elements that the Lamanites were good people. And that war should be avoided at all costs. Alma tells his brothers in verses 23 to 25, "Now do you remember, my brethren, that we said unto our brethren in the land of Zarahemla, we go up to the land of Nephi to preach unto our brethren the Lamanites, and they laughed us to scorn? For they said unto us," and a lot of this does sound familiar, "Do ye suppose that you can bring the Lamanites to knowledge of the truth? Do ye suppose that you can convince the Lamanites of the incorrectness of the traditions of their fathers, as stiff-necked a people as they are, whose hearts delight in the shedding of blood, whose days have been spent in the grossest iniquity, whose ways have been the ways of a transgressor from the beginning? No, my brethren, you remember that that was their language, and moreover, they did say, 'Let us take up arms against them, that we destroy them and their iniquity out of the land, lest they overrun us and destroy us.' But behold, my beloved brethren, we came into the wilderness, not with the intent to destroy our brethren, but with the intent that perhaps we might save some few of their souls." Ammon's speech in the language of the hawkish Nephites does feel incredibly contemporary. The arguments for preemptive war are similar. And the following is an email we received on the peace walk that kind of sounds similar as well. One anonymous Mormon emailer said, "I want peace too, but how exactly do you negotiate peace with those who have no interest in it? Those who do not want peace, who only see peace if it involves the complete disappearance of any who do not agree with their ways of life. And after the annihilation of all those who do not agree, the subjugation of those who do agree. That's the plan of Satan." In their piece of activism, the Sons of Mosiah had the excellent example of Nephi. It's not always obvious, but the Book of Mormon starts out with Lehi being a peace activist, preaching against political and social decisions that would lead to an unnecessary war in Babylon. One interesting part of this fate is the fact that Nephi says in the first chapter of the Book of Mormon that many prophets came to Jerusalem with the same message, including Jeremiah. This gives the impression that there was a grassroots peace movement going on. Lehi and Jeremiah had both received personal revelation, and they needed to speak out against the actions that would participate in the destruction of Jerusalem. In Hugh Nibley's book, Lehi in the Desert, he references the Lachish letters, which give a rare glimpse into the politics of that exact time period. Driven by greed and the promise of increased wealth, the officials of Jerusalem wanted to align themselves with Egypt. This would, however, provoke an unnecessary war with Babylon. According to Nibley, the Lachish letters show that the elders of Israel denounced Jeremiah to the king, demanding that he be executed because of his bad influence on the morale of the people. Again, some of this rhetoric is familiar. One of the leading criticisms of the peace movement from the war in Iraq is that protesting might damage the morale of the troops or break the will of the American people. And so for preaching peace, Jeremiah is denounced as a, quote, traitor, defeatist, and collaborator of Babylon. Lehi eventually has to leave Jerusalem, but he continues to get persecution from his family. More than once, his family members refer to him derisively as a visionary man. They might also have called him a wild man. The political situation, much like today, causes great strain on Lehi's family. Hugh Nibley observes the elder sons, reared to a life of Egyptian elegance and heirs to the fortune that owed much to Egypt, were staunch defenders of the status quo. While the younger sons, less spoiled by all accounts, had been made aware of the real nature of the crisis in Jerusalem, which was not really an economic or political, but basically a moral one. The older men could not see this at all. The people who were in the land of Jerusalem, they protested, were a righteous people, for they kept the statutes according to the law of Moses. Wherefore, we know that they are a righteous people. Such was the holy chauvinism of the false prophets with their gospel of business as usual, Nibley says. So we see that the pro-war rhetoric and marginalization of peace activists is consistent despite time and geography. When Marshall finished the peace walk through Utah, we came home and we did feel like we needed to get involved with things in our community. So we joined a peace group and worked alongside Unitarians and Quakers, organizing events to promote peace in Logan. We learned of the group Mormons for Equality and Social Justice, also known as MESSAGE, and we started a Cache Valley chapter so we could meet with like-minded Mormons and talk about these issues. At our first meeting, we talked about the responsibility of stewardship for the earth that we share, and we talked about how we could be actively engaged in this cause. And so after some discussion, we realized that no churches in our town of Logan have any kind of recycling program or system. And we thought, let's change it. Let's be actively engaged and start a recycling program in Logan. So we did this, and naively, perhaps we were surprised that we were met with some resistance. One bishop said, "I'm all for saving the earth and all, but is this really worth it?" Some members expressed their annoyance that first the city forced them to recycle because everyone in Logan must have or pay for recycling receptacles, and now the church will too. When my sister, who's right here, she was trying to get the program announced at a Christmas party because we'd just gotten receptacles. She wanted them to recycle at the Christmas party, put their cups in the right place. So she wanted to make a little announcement, and the organizing committee felt like that would be inappropriate during the Christmas party, so they didn't want to be a part of that. This is another example of we're doing all that we can. We're doing all the important things, so you know, don't bother us with that thing. Let's see. So when we started talking to church officials to clear the project, we learned, surprisingly, that the current handbook of instructions says that there shall be, quote, no recycling receptacles on church grounds, a line that we hope will be omitted in the future. Despite that clause, though, the church officials sanctioned the project on a trial basis, and we're still working on making these changes permanent and churchwide. But one of the more hurtful comments that we did get appeared in the comment section of our local newspaper after they wrote a story about it. A reader said that my sister and I were on the road to apostasy for doing this. Because, of course, if God wanted the churches, the people to recycle in the churches, he would have told the prophet, and it would have gone that way. Of course, he is unaware of the grassroots efforts in the church, in the LDS church, that have precipitated major changes throughout its history, like, to name a few, Relief Society, Word of Wisdom, Primary Program, etc. Considering this, I think that we can assume that God expects and demands some grassroots activism within the church to make it better, to improve it. There's a lot of precedence for, and a lot of context to understand environmental activism today, but it's rarely applied back to people in the scriptures like Enoch and Noah. According to various accounts of the Book of Enoch, one of the main themes was the people's sins against the environment. In the Book of Giants contained in the Dead Sea Scrolls, Enoch tells the people that they need to stop harming the earth. Hugh Nibley underlines the point in his book, Enoch the Prophet. He shows how the impending flood was an environmental disaster that naturally followed environmental degradation. Enoch spoke out for Mother Earth, and we see a lot of people doing that today. Not all Mormons, but we have a similar situation. As we encountered minor resistance while setting up our recycling program, we were encouraged to see this precedence for environmental activism from Enoch and Noah, that their marginalization and resistance that they met are common threads that span thousands of years. Now, although I am quite comfortable with being seen at peace rallies now and being called an activist, I feel that some of my insecurities may have stemmed from a lack of knowledge about the heritage of activism that I share with my foremothers who fought for women's suffrage over 1,000 years ago. 100 years ago. Sorry. I am not sure why it took me 28 years of membership in the LDS Church to finally learn about the incredible stories of activism. But I do know that the bios of past Relief Society presidents that are currently on the church website of women like Bathsheba Smith and Emmeline B. Wells, they don't quite paint the same picture of radical feminism and women's suffrage activism that I've heard about recently. I'm not going to take too much time to talk about this because I know Marshall has a lot more to say, and I don't want to have him run out of time. But I am amazed by the women that went before me and fought for equal rights and fought for the right to vote. And when I was growing up, I heard a little glimpse of this, that women fought for the right to vote in Utah before other states, and I kind of got really excited that I had some connection with these early Mormon women who at the time I saw as only polygamous, subservient, silent women. And then somebody quickly shot that down and said, oh, they were only doing that so men would have more power because they all had tons of wives. And so instantly that was crushed, and I thought, ah, of course. And the whole feeling of polygamy came back, and I just kind of ignored that. And I think, what a shame that is going around, and a lot of things are growing around. And there were a lot of political situations going on back then that were motives for women speaking up for women's suffrage. And I understand those. But these women, and from when I read their accounts and read what they wrote in the Women's Exponent and how they were involved in the national movement for women's suffrage, and they started the Utah chapter, and they talked with people like Susan B. Anthony, and they were so involved in the movement. I really feel like I have a heritage of activism, and I owe a lot of that to them, and I'm so grateful for them speaking out for what they believed in. And they met resistance too, and they had awakenings to the cause, and they had such similar experiences, and I'm grateful to be tied to those women. And Marshall's going to talk about some civil rights activism in the scriptures now, so...
Oh, it's all right. Sorry, everybody.
It's because I have it. Sorry, everybody.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. Oh, okay, here we are. Sorry about that. Just making sure you're paying attention. Okay. We do have a lot of scriptural examples of nonviolent activism for civil rights, just as we have modern examples of these wonderful heroines from the suffrage movement. In Peacefully Refusing to Follow Unjust Laws, Daniel gives us one of the greatest examples of civil disobedience. In Daniel chapter 6, we read the oft-told story of the lion's den. The king is tricked into making a law that outlawed Daniel's religious worship. Today we would say that this law violated his human right to religious freedom. In verse 10 we read, quote, "Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed, gave thanks before his God, as he did aforetime." So Daniel knowingly disobeyed a law, and the Lord protected him from the consequences when he was thrown into the lion's den. If this doesn't show divine approval for civil disobedience, then certainly the example of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego does. Like Daniel, they were in a similar situation. In Daniel chapter 3, they refused to follow a law that required them to worship an idol. So King Nebuchadnezzar had them thrown into a fiery furnace. But God, again, protected them. While they were in the furnace, untouched by the fire, the king sees a fourth figure that is like the Son of God. We can see similarities between the early Mormons of this time period fighting for civil rights with the brave Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego fighting for their civil liberties in Babylon. According to a Mormon theological understanding, despite different time periods, they were all drawing inspiration and direction from the same source, Jesus Christ. The Savior is the archetypal activist, and his example and teachings are the foundation of our modern understanding of nonviolent activism. After our walk, Kristen and I moved to Jerusalem to do an internship with the Associated Press. And while I was there, I was able to apply the lens of activism to the life of Christ more fully than I had before. Seminal events like the Sermon on the Mount became more concrete in my mind, and I'd like to quickly share a few thoughts on that from a Mormon activist perspective. First off, I think the paintings that we use in the Church of the Sermon on the Mount are very nice, but I think they miss the point. I love the Karl Heinrich Block painting, but it doesn't quite capture the scene in the way that I think it probably came out. If you can imagine, he had gathered disciples and throngs of people who were following him, and he went just above the Sea of Galilee up on a hill, and there he gave this speech. And if you can imagine standing before thousands of people, or however many people there were, without amplification equipment, that he must have been yelling, crying out in a loud voice, just like Enoch had yelled in a loud voice from the hills and the high places before. And so, in terms of the tone and pacing, I would suggest that the Sermon on the Mount sounded less like a general conference talk or a Sunstone symposium presentation, and sounded more like a protest speech, and probably sounded more like Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech than anything else. The Sermon on the Mount is often interpreted in LDS Sunday schools as something abstract, full of deep spiritual symbols and parables. Otherwise, how could the meek inherit the earth? It just doesn't make sense. But several wise people throughout history have understood the full power of the Sermon on the Mount. This power is based on the rare but common sense conclusion that Jesus actually meant what he was saying. Leo Tolstoy understood this. In his nonfiction book, The Kingdom of God is Within You, he lays out how Christ's teaching can be literally applied to make the world a better place. And this essentially is the underpinnings of what we call nonviolent non-resistance or nonviolent activism today. Tolstoy admits, though, in a revision of the book, that he's not the originator of such radical and subversive ideas. The first chapter in the revised book is called "The Doctrine of Non-Resistance to Evil by Force Has Been Professed by a Minority of Men from the Very Foundation of Christianity. It is nothing new under the sun." In 1908, Tolstoy wrote a letter to a Hindu, which ran in an Indian newspaper, and explained the principles of nonviolent activism based on the Sermon on the Mount, and how this could be applied to help them overthrow the British government. A young Mohandas Gandhi read it while in South Africa and struck up a correspondence with Tolstoy. They corresponded for 1 year before Tolstoy died in 1910. It convinced Gandhi that he needed to embrace nonviolence, and that would be his path. Gandhi was perhaps the supreme practitioner of Christ's teaching, although he was often dismayed between the disconnect between Jesus and the Christians who purport to follow him. In helping to establish a free and independent country for India, Gandhi provided a wonderful example that in turn inspired Martin Luther King Jr. According to Paul Hawken, the author of A Blessed Unrest and former press secretary of King, the man known in America for nonviolent protest against segregation didn't start out that way. Martin Luther King Jr. used to carry guns with him wherever he went because he was afraid for his life, and rightfully so. But after reading the teachings of Gandhi and the teachings of Tolstoy and the teachings of Christ at the Sermon on the Mount, he had an awakening and realized that all of his protests and all of his actions needed to be done nonviolently. Martin Luther King Jr. and Gandhi were ultimately successful in their righteous goals. They both ended up as martyrs, assassinated for their causes, just as Jesus Christ had done before them. It is a common understanding that people in Jerusalem had expected Christ to be a liberator with a sword. Instead, he liberated their souls through the atonement. While I agree with this, I think that if the people in Palestine under the yoke of the Romans had literally applied the principles of the Sermon on the Mount, that they would have been liberated in a literal and temporal sense as well as a spiritual sense. The fact that Christ's teachings failed to be adopted immediately and were ultimately unsuccessful in regard to the Roman rule of Jerusalem makes the scripture in John 14, chapter 12, make a little bit more sense. It says, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that believeth on me, the works that I do shall he do also. And greater works than these shall he do, because I go unto my Father." So it's our hope today that we've maybe given you some good thoughts and some inspirations. I hope that we can all embrace the proud heritage of our descent, protest, and activism in the Mormon tradition, and that we can do the works of Jesus Christ, and that in so doing we can make the world a better place. Thanks.
Thank you. We now have time for questions and comments. And if you have a question or a comment, can you come up to the mic so we can get your input for the recording? Okay.
I just want to thank you for your activism. Unfortunately, as a culture, we seem to allow activism. It just has to be the correct activism. So, I mean, you can... I remember years ago at BYU being opposed to the Vietnam War and working with the student body officers to distribute pamphlets that were anti-war. We were taken to task because you were allowed and encouraged to demonstrate for the war, but you were not allowed to demonstrate against it. And I know where we live, it's just fine to go to the Republican, you know, and to have that huge, or our greatest, you know, what we just did in California. Sadly, to me, I disagree with all of these positions and carry a certain amount of other activism, our history, like on ERA. So we seem to be able to do activism on a narrow or a conservative or a Republican front, which almost seems more cultural to me. Sometimes it's commanded, as opposed to things where we're supposed to believe that we should be actively engaged in a good cause. So I don't even know what the debate about recycling is, other than I guess recycling is evil. But yeah, being opposed to the Iraq War, which I certainly was and marched, seems to be a divine right and a divine sort of calling. So we do allow activism. It just needs to be cultural. So would you comment on that? Because, and I'm glad you're activists.
Okay. Now that's a very good point, and it's something we discussed as we prepared this. Part of the reason why we defined activism as we did was to say that you're fighting against the status quo, against the cultural hegemony, and I think that's really a big difference between sort of I'd call it pseudo-activism. If you're doing a rally to promote the status quo, it's an interesting situation. I think it actually harkens back to what Hunebelle calls this chauvinistic holiness, or this holy chauvinism, saying that what we're doing right now is exactly what we're supposed to be doing, and it's always been what we're supposed to be doing, and there's this resistance to any kind of change, which we understand from a Mormon perspective is repentance. And so, and if you look at these prophets or these activist models in the scriptures, they're always in the minority. They're these marginalized fringe groups, essentially, trying to tell the world that the way they're doing things is incorrect. And so when we see actions against the ERA and against the Prop 8 in California and pro-war rallies, things that maintain the status quo, I think we can clearly identify that is not in the tradition of scriptural activism. Yes?
Just to use or repeat my question, would you comment, it mystifies me, but maybe I'm the only one in this room, that, I read a poll about the Iraq War, and Mormons were the most supportive group in the United States, comparable to evangelical Christians, but I think actually slightly more supportive, whereas other religious groups were opposed. And in my lifetime, it seems like in terms of lining up behind the United States wars, and as I read the Book of Mormon, I read other things, it seems like peace should be, is consistent with religious spiritual principles. Why do you think Mormons are so supportive of our military, not our military intervention, so to speak, which is disheartening to me. I don't get it. But.
Yeah, that is disheartening, and we've had a lot of time to contemplate this, and there's a lot of different aspects going in. We saw an interesting thing yesterday about how the atonement's been misinterpreted and how that can justify violence and military intervention in several cases. I think a lot of it happens as you look through Mormon history and our relationship with the greater United States. And to a large degree, a lot of I think a lot of our attitude today is we want to belong. We want to be accepted by a political party or a group that have traditionally... We don't want to be in the wilderness anymore, essentially. And so, to a large part, we've divorced our radical activist heritage, and we've kind of accepted the status quo. In some cases, we've championed the status quo, even when it was in direct opposition to the scriptures.
During Vietnam War, I was in junior high school and watched my own confusion. I was in Los Angeles, the most liberal area of Los Angeles, at high school we were having protests. And, marching in the Patriot Buildings. And I was in there watching with my Mormon background, watching them, but why don't we trust the authorities? Why do you think they're doing something wrong? Because I grew up in this obedience culture of respect for authority. By the time we got to the Persian Gulf War, I was saying, this doesn't feel right to me. By the time we got to the Iraq War, I was in Logan, Utah, with these kids. I was total conservative, and I was teaching at university and feeling like I couldn't take a political stand. But my daughter knew how I felt, and she protested at high school and got arrested, and knew when she would help tell me what she'd do about it, and I would be very supportive. But so I could see in my own self how that transition occurred from this obedience culture of, why would you question, if those in charge of making decisions to
accept. It depends on who we're obeying.
Yeah.
If that's to be a Republican, we obey.
Totally. And we're a much more divided country now, where we are willing to question the other side. But at that time, even in the early Clinton years, we were much less questioning. So that's just part of my
theory. Interesting. Thank you.
Well, what I wanted to say actually goes quite well with what you said. As a student of the Book of Mormon, it was very apparent to me that the Book of Mormon teaches that preemptive war is always wrong. And not only is it wrong, it is absolutely the worst thing that you can ever do. And it teaches very clearly that, you know, if the Nephites ever do this, God will stop supporting them. And so it seemed to me that since Mormons have been told to read the Book of Mormon, that they would get this. This is not an esoteric, difficult to understand principle. It's right there. So I was so confused. Even when I pointed this out to people, they would come up with all kinds of rationalizations why this was a different kind of thing. And my conclusion was finally that we have been taught as Mormons so much that we should obey our leaders, and that the prophet will never lead us astray, and that we should always, you know, have this obedience mentality, that it has made it very difficult for most Mormons to use their own judgment. And I have seen time and time again where if we are allowed to use our own judgment, we can see what is just.
Mm-hmm.
I think Proposition 8 is another important area. If people are allowed to use their own judgment, they can see that it is a social injustice to deny these people the right to marry. And so I see it as the very, very unfortunate, wrong development in Mormonism, which is to think that we have to follow the prophet. The prophet will tell us everything, and the prophet will never lead us astray.
Yeah. And along with that, we did run into the idea that we wouldn't be to blame. No matter what
yes,
we did,
exactly.
We're not to blame.
Exactly.
And we see that in so many other examples that you can just say, well, I'll do whatever I'm told, and then I won't have any responsibility for my actions. And I think that's what a lot of Mormons were thinking when they supported the war as well. So, yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I'd really like to thank you for this paper. In my own activism over the past year, one of the conclusions I drew was that it's absolutely necessary to do some work within the community, to do the theology and to do the history and to make it safe for people to be activists. And I think that's exactly what you're doing here, is you're showing an interpretation and doing the theological work to say, oh, no, wait a minute, this really is part of who we are as a people. And the other thing that I've come across that you guys pointed at, but you didn't put quite the sort of naming on it, and that is that there's a real threat. The activist poses a real threat to certain aspects of Mormon culture. And one is that, as some of those comments that you're reading that you've got, Mormon culture assumes that God speaks in a monologue. And the presence of the activist insists upon dialogue, and that's so threatening. You know, that we don't know, Mormon culture doesn't know how to receive that, and we really found that out in Prop 8, you know, over in California. And then the other thing is, I'm really glad you're talking about agency and like the Huebner example during World War II. And then we can also add Dietrich Bonhoeffer, not a Mormon, but a very important ethical voice, that there's a conflation in Mormon culture the idea that we are Abraham to the prophet. You know, like when God commands Abraham to kill Isaac, you know, this is a tremendous ethical crisis. But he celebrated as in the purity of his obedience. But what we really—I don't think that's the right way to celebrate it. It's his faith, not his obedience, that matters. And that we don't seem to differentiate between Abraham and God and ourselves and the prophet. I don't think any leader of the church can ask us to suspend the ethical or our own ethical obligations. That's critical to the point you guys are making. And the other thing the activist does, and this is my last point, is that when the activist points out or is willing to admit that a prophet is capable of speaking from an ideological point of view. And that's the other really terrifying thing for other people in the Mormon culture. That's what you guys have done, is you point out where ideology is being promoted as theology, and that or doctrine, and that's a tremendously threatening thing to people. But appreciate you having your work in your paper.
Oh, thanks a lot.
We have 5 minutes, so we have five minutes left.
I think not wanting to mix politics with religion again, but there's a past that said it's okay to be a Democrat or Mormon. I think Mormons don't believe that still.
No.
I think anything that George W. Bush would say, since he speaks about Jesus, he's led by Jesus. And so if you cross anything that... Also, Laban, I mean, it's better that one nation, one man be destroyed than a nation. I think religion tends to be military and in defense of righteousness. The only true church or the only true country in the world has to kill anybody that stands in the way.
I totally agree. For whatever reason, militarism, well, I believe it's a satanic twist on religion. And that's why the example of Christ is so important. He came to set things straight and show us what we should do. You mentioned the way people talk about George Bush. He prays. He must be good. I heard that a lot. And that sounds exactly the way, like what Laman and Lemuel were saying about the people in Jerusalem. They adhere to the statutes of the law so that we know they're good people. It doesn't matter that they're precipitating an unnecessary war. They're keeping the statutes of the law. That's something we've seen.
Can I just make one point, too? We did run into so many amazing LDS people
that walked
with us, that encouraged us, that felt the same way we did about activism and the war in Iraq. And that was really helpful and really inspiring as well. It really helped counter the other side of things. So.
Yeah, we used the bad experiences because they mirrored the scriptures better.
As a fellow activist down at BYU, I applaud you, especially your efforts. I know what it's like helping to start the BYU plastics recycling program down there.
Excellent.
They finally ended up starting. So I was.
Yeah, we've heard about that.
I was just wondering, you guys seem to like organize stuff. If there was like a website or a Facebook group where like Mormon activists could kind of like get together and let each other know what was going on, what was happening, kind of a thing.
Yes.
Know of anything?
There's an organization we've really enjoyed is Mormons for Equality and Social Justice. And you can get online. There's a couple of different websites and get in touch that way.
Yeah.
I liked when you said that being awakened to the cause is a calling to act. And I think that when you do have that call, the only way that you can be honest with yourself and be justified before God is to act on it. You also indicated that with Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that there was divine approval for their actions because they ended up being okay. But, you know, for most activists, it's not a happy ending. And you talked about, you know, most of these guys ended up being murdered. And I think that we don't want to listen to activists outside of the church because they're not the leaders of our church. They don't have what we would consider the authority of revelation. But we don't want to be activists within the church because we aren't in the hierarchical structure to receive the revelation for the church. And I think that's part of the reason so many of us feel hampered or frozen or unable to do anything, and why as a culture we tend to disregard modern day prophets like Wendell Berry or even Al Gore with the Inconvenient Truth, who are really voices in the wilderness calling us to act.
Exactly. There's a huge rejection of an activist telling Mormons what to do, because only our prophet tells us what to do, essentially. But when you understand it, it all comes back to agency. And you know, I believe in absolute obedience to God. Everybody else comes second. And I think if we take that attitude, we'll accept truth wherever it comes, and we'll change for the better.
I have a the kid who, when he was about 17, he was asked to talk in Sacramento. And he'd been an active kid. He organized a food drive for his Eagle Scout project, and he was into recycling. And so he gave a talk on recycling and environmentalism, and pointed out that all the people there in church who filled up the parking lot with their cars was less than a block away. And could have walked. Well, the state president was horrified. He said that environmentalism has nothing to do with the gospel and wouldn't let him serve a mission.
So
that was kind of odd. I think it's interesting that with respect to agency, that as a free people, we tend to wait for permission to become autonomous and make our own decisions. I had a theory that I get a lot of flack for, but I think perhaps the church takes the wrong position on every social issue to encourage us to think for ourselves.
You know, that's funny.
I'm not sure how well it's
working. I've come to a similar conclusion. I've become thankful for Sunday school lessons that are challenging because they give me an opportunity every Sunday to stand up and say what I believe in. The example of this young man, or the young man who can serve a mission because of his speech on environmentalism, I think brings up a good point. A friend of mine once asked, and we'd been talking about the rich history of environmentalism, especially in the Enoch period, and he said, why don't Mormons teach about environmentalism? Like, why don't you teach environmental issues? And my first reaction was to say, well, I guess the prophet doesn't get it, sorry. But then the Spirit kind of touched me and said, why don't you? And I realized that we are all, in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we teach the lessons, we give the talks, we give the prayers, we make the comments in Sunday school. And so when my friend asked, why don't we teach about environmentalism, I said, you're right, I'm going to do that more. And and it's hard for the first people who do it, but that just means that we need to get behind them and keep mentioning it, and keep bringing it up, and keep giving talks about this, because this is our church. And ultimately, we're going to help define what the Lord wants to make out of it.
One more thing on war and environmentalism. Those that believe in the second coming think, well, hey, the world's going to be destroyed anyway. Yeah. Because God, that's, I mean,
that's right. Oh, okay. Thanks a lot.
Excellent. If you have any more questions and comments, you can come up and talk to the panelists. And thank you for coming.